I feel lots of horrible things. Envy isn't one of them, because I don't think that there's a finite amount of success in the world. So I don't believe that if somebody else has something, it's
they're
not
taking it away from you. Yeah. Yeah.
So that is not to say that I am not power hungry, obsessed with being fuckable, you know, all of the things that we all are.
Prepare your ears, humans. Happy, Sad, Confused begins now.
I'm Josh Horowitz. Today on Happy, Sad, Confused, it's Emerald Fennell. In my opinion, she's one of the most exciting filmmakers working today. She knocked me out with Promising Young Woman, which earned her a well-deserved Oscar. She is back with the audacious, the hypnotic, the sexy. I don't even know if there are enough adjectives for this one. Saltburn is the movie. Seek this one out. It will rock your world. Here she is, the one and only Emerald Fennell. Hello.
Hello. I sort of thought maybe I should clap myself.
Yeah, no, please. Feel free.
Sort of silent.
If you're happy with any of your answers as you go, feel free to clap.
Just a little applause machine. I love happy. That's how I feel all the time.
Isn't it? We're all a blend of that. And I know you're feeling that because I saw you the other day and they're running you for a good cause. We're spreading the good word of Saltburn. What's on the caffeinated coherent meter today, Emerald? How are you doing?
I am so caffeinated. I'm so caffeinated that at this stage, I may as well be nailing kind of a gram of Coke a day. I mean, I think there comes a point when you've had 38 coffees where really it's just a problem. But no, I'm fine. You know, luckily, I really love talking about this film. And I really, really love the cast. And so I'm always happy to talk about it.
So I want to give a little context because we've never had kind of the deep dive conversation. And I was such a fan of Promising Young Woman and much of your earlier work. I'm curious, like, where you sit today. Is this kind of where you were aiming to be? Has the goal been for a while to be a writer director crafting these personal, very powerful kind of stories for the big screen?
I mean, absolutely. I don't think I could have dreamed it would have been. I don't think I could have dreamed it would have got me here, like in a hotel in front of a green screen in New York, pretending to be, you know, it's like kind of like.
No, that's real. Emerald, don't you ruin the illusion.
Sorry,
that's her. Sorry. That's her home.
I never thought it would get me to hear this very real sitting room that I'm absolutely sitting in. What I mean to say is that to me, to have a green screen is beyond
the goal. Goals. Yeah.
It's like I've made it. That's a huge deal for me.
Right.
And I think, you know, everything that happened with Promising a Woman, you know, was just beyond all of our wildest dreams while we were making it. So I just feel kind of amazed constantly, honestly, that it's been so amazing.
It was a strange ride, needless to say, for Promising Young Woman. I was lucky enough to be at the Sundance screening, the premiere of it. I spoke to your cast there. And then, of course, this was January 2020. If you do the math, some things occurred pretty soon thereafter. Did you feel like you had, look, you obviously reaped the rewards. I mean, Carrie got the nomination. She almost took home the Oscar. You took home an Oscar. But I would imagine, I don't know, you probably didn't get to celebrate in a full way with that cast. We were all siloed off. Did it feel that way at the time? Did it feel a little strange?
I think, well, I had no frame of reference. It was my first movie. I just had a baby. So, you know, I had a kid and I was pregnant as well by the time it all sort of started kicking off. And it was lockdown. So it was just everything about the circumstances were completely unprecedented. And my own life had, you know, was changing in every kind of conceivable way. And so I suppose then I didn't really, I had no way of knowing what was strange and what was normal. And, you know, it was all upside down. So in many ways, I'm glad that it was the way that it was, because it meant that, now I'm doing this sort of publicity tour. And this obviously is also peculiar, because normally the actors would be doing right. all the stuff that I'm doing, which would have been like vastly my preference, because, you know, you don't really want to center yourself as a filmmaker like this. It's not kind of natural or useful in lots of ways. But I think that I'm, you know, I was glad that I I was able to kind of carry on with my life.
Yeah.
I wrote, and the cast, who was so amazing, you know, really helped. But it meant I could sort of get on with the thing that I wanted to make next, which was Saltburn.
Have you stayed in touch? I'm curious. I know you're obviously in touch with Carrie. She's amazing in this film. Bo Burnham is an enigma to me. He actually did my podcast for Promising Young Woman, and it was like one of the only bits, like extended conversations he had. And then he disappeared. And then he came out with his album, right? His comedy album. Has he retired from acting? He's like Daniel Day-Lewis. Like, what happened to him?
He's an immensely private person. And so I would never kind of want to break his trust by talking about him, but he's absolutely one of my favorite people. He is wonderful, deeply wonderful. I think, you know, like a lot of great artists, he's just, you know, he just wants to concentrate on making right. things.
Right.
And he's so good that he can. And I'm very excited for whatever he does next.
Before we get to Saltburn, a couple of other things on Promising Young Woman. Did your use of Stars Are Blind bring you closer to Paris Hilton? Have you broken bread with her? Have you bonded in a real way?
We have not broken bread, but we have met a few times. I love her. I'm always and have always been from the very beginning inspired by her fortitude and her grace and her ability to find humor in lots of circumstances and lots of treatment that was, you know, revoltingly misogynistic and gross. And I think she's an incredibly clever person and an interesting person, and so it was really wonderful as well that people kind of acknowledged that Stars Are Blind is a fucking brilliant song.
Yeah,
because that's why it's in there because it's like one of the greats, and I'm so glad that it very occasionally means that people play it when I go somewhere, and it means I can listen to it.
You took the irony out of it. I feel like it had like quotation marks around it, and now it's kind of like, we can just acknowledge it's actually a really cool, fun song.
Totally. And also, do you know what? I don't like irony in general.
Yeah.
I think it's a real cop out, and it's a really, it's a very inhibiting thing for making stuff. Actually, like I don't think irony is helpful because it's a lie. You know, it's double talk. You're pussyfooting. And again, that's the thing for me that I, you know, try as much as I can do is say, like, you know, things do not have to be all done in the same way.
Right.
You can be earnest. You can earnestly love things. You can be unsubtle. You can be overwrought. You can be melodramatic and gothic. You can be all those things. There is space in the world for art is too much of a like absolutely wanky phrase, but there's space in the world for things to be expressed in all manner of different ways. And I think we're still very, you know, very preoccupied with a certain mode and method of storytelling. And so I try as much as I can to just make things that feel like, I don't know, the sort of things that I responded to when I was younger, and hope that that finds its sort of connection.
There is like there's this like kind of ruthless honesty in these two films, like the messiness of desire, of wanting, of love, of lust. And it's like, we're all, you know, a lot of us, most of us, sadly, for whatever reason, feel shame about these feelings when in fact, literally every human being feels what you experience, what the characters experience in Saltburn.
But isn't shame part of the fun? Isn't
right.
shame
makes it more
a necessary part of why something is sexy?
Right.
Because that's the other thing too, right? Is
right.
that you can't have one without the other.
Right.
Really, not when it gets super, super, you know. The thing that is transgressive, the threshold being crossed, is often what makes something so powerful. And that is really what the gothic is about. It is about revulsion and desire colliding. It is about giving yourself over to something that frightens you. And so it's interesting, like, actually, in some ways, it's why watching this in a room full of people is so important, because you don't really have that sense of, you don't have the sense of kind of potent arousal and shame and confusion and revulsion on your own.
Right.
You know, because you may as well go on, you know, we're all doing all sorts of things on our own that are absolutely shocking. I mean, not me, because my life's incredibly boring, but
not in that room. You wouldn't know.
Oh, not in this room. Yeah, you know what's behind the green screen. It's actually a dungeon. It's my own. That's the thing for me, is that all of that stuff is good. It's good to be pushing always. And that's why I think, you know, we look at period dramas as romances. Increasingly, all of the romantic fiction, all the romantic movies and TV is set in the past. And right. I think that's because there were so many more boundaries, and that we understand when those boundaries are kind of pushed, right? You understand that if a glance lingers too long in Regency England, that everyone's going to fuck, and it's a disaster, and it might ruin a woman's life. Not a man's, of course, he'll be fine. But,
but
now, you know, we are all of us kind of, you know, embracing the kink, embracing the things that interest us and stuff. And it's wonderfully, everyone's more comfortable with it. But in terms of dramatic narratives, yeah, you're looking to find the thing that gets inside you in a way that's sort of truly sexy and disturbing.
What were those transgressive films for you as a young person? What were the ones that shook your worldview?
Mm-hmm. Well, mine were the ones that now I recognize are like very troubling, because they were sort of, you know, something like The Crush with Alicia Silverstone and Carrie Elwes,
right,
where she's like a 14-year-old girl. And of course, at the time, I was like 10, so she seemed really old. And now I'm Carrie Elwes's age from the film, and I'm like, well, this is not a good film at all. I shouldn't have shaped my entire personality on this film. You know, there was The Crush. There were things like Secretary, which I was obsessed with, you know, Cruel Intentions, The Dreamers, Stealing Beauty.
Did Bram Stoker's Dracula feel like that for you? I'm curious.
Oh, totally. I mean, Bram Stoker's Dracula is just one of my all-time favorites. I mean, that movie is insanely good. Also, shout out to Dracula Dead and Loving It, the spoof that came. Also terrific. Yeah. In a different way. But also, like, it was also the feeling of having a crush on the characters you weren't supposed to have a crush on. Like, wanting to know what Jafar's deal was.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Thinking like Scar's kind of interesting. I bet I could change it.
I do, yeah. It's not just that thing of
like sexy movies, but it's the way that you as a young person, as a person, as a human in general, respond to things. You're told that you should like this lovely golden prince or princess or whatever, but you're like, but who's that horrible like little thing?
The gnome in the corner. I want that one.
Scary little, yeah, exactly. That little sort of goblin. I'm like,
Well, yeah, I heard I was telling you, I loved your conversation with Brett Goldstein a couple years back. And I think you professed your love for Buscemi in Armageddon. That tells you all you need to know. You didn't go for Affleck.
No, it was Buscemi. I mean, Buscemi in everything forever. Obsessed.
I mean, there's certain roles. I don't know.
I mean, Billy Madison, him putting his lipstick on to ELO's telephone line, and Billy Madison is scorched in my memory.
This one will be scorched in many a young person's memory, I think. How fully formed did Saltburn come? Does it start with a character, an image, just a mash of ideas?
It starts with a character, which usually is accompanied by an image. And it's I suppose it's a bit spoilery, the first thing that came to me. But really it was Oliver. And it was Oliver, and it was a young man kind of insisting, and it was like the first moment of the film, first breath of the film, is I wasn't in love with him. And you know, my feeling was just, if you start a conversation like that, you know, you're immediately announcing yourself as somebody who's, you know, very either much. Lying to us. Yeah, lying to us or lying to themselves. And so that's a kind of interesting, and I suppose that early on I realized it was part of that, yeah, British country house sort of Gothic tradition, just because of the nature of the way he was talking. He was talking to me. It felt like a first person narrative. And then what happens is, you know, I just live in the world. I live with him and I live in the world for a long, long time. So I went to Saltburn and I spent years there just kind of with all the characters, and, you know, and it becomes, it's a sort of, it's both kind of narratively in character, but it's also kind of texture as well. It's kind of like, what do the rooms feel like? Are they hot? Are they cold? Do they smell? What does the grass feel like? It's all that kind of sensory. It's like sensory as well. If you're writing in your head, which I do, it can be as like sensory as it is like intellectual. Sure. I guess you're kind of feeling things very much from a sort of physical and emotional point of view, which is really how I like to start anything. And then over the years it's a bit like, and I say this as a person who really does not like immersive theater, I respect it and God bless everyone doing it, but I find it truly excruciating. But for me, that is kind of what it is. It's like I'm there, and it's only when I've been in every room 1,000 times that I feel like every version of every conversation has happened,
right?
And it's not changing. It sort of ceases to change for a long time. Then I know, okay, it's ready to, I can write it down now.
And for the uninitiated, I do want to give some little context. So Oliver, played by the great Barry Keoghan, young man in Oxford, who, yes, becomes, we don't really know what the desire is exactly, but there is a desire around Felix, played by Jacob Elordi, and goes to his estate and kind of becomes enmeshed in this very unique family. And wackiness ensues. That's probably not the right
wackiness. Do you know what? When I had an interview,
was that your elevator pitch? Was that it?
I had a Q&A. I did a Q&A after a screening of the movie a few weeks ago, and the girl who was interviewing me said, "Well, you're a wacky gal." I was like, "Cool, okay. I mean, sure." Okay. I mean, yeah, it's a film about like how all of us feel, which is that you go to college or, you know, you go to a new place and you have this opportunity to like, you think like you're going to be the sexiest, your life's going to begin. You're going to finally be the person you want to be. And then you get to that place and you realize like, oh no, you're just another dork.
Right.
Like, and it's about how we, yeah. And Oliver sees this boy, Felix, and then his group of friends too. And he's just like the center of the universe. He's beautiful and he has everything. And Oliver, you know, at first has disdain for him. And then of course their worlds collide and he can't help but like immediately fall for his charms. And then, you know, they become friends and it kind of carries on from there. But I think we all know what that feels like, to want to be cool, to want to be unique and special and sexy and all of those things. Like, it's in that way, it's, I think, it's a very like relatable movie.
100%. Does that feeling, which is very much tied, I think, especially to the ages we're seeing these characters in, but it also never does go away. Like, do you feel that, look, you have an Oscar and a prosperous career, a family. Do you feel desire and envy? Is it, I mean, it's not cool to say that, but I think we all feel it.
It's not, do you know what? It's really interesting because I do try to be honest about these things. I don't feel envy. It's not one of, I feel lots of horrible things. Envy isn't one of them, because I don't think that there's a finite amount of success in the world. So I don't believe that if somebody else has something, it's
not taking it away from you. Yeah. Yeah.
So that is not to say that I am not power hungry, obsessed with being fuckable. You know, all of the things that we all are, right?
Right.
Of course, yeah. Of course you want, there's no, like, there is no human on earth who is telling the truth, who says they don't want people to think they're funny and cool and clever and sexy and whatever. Like, that's just all of us. Like, is there anyone who goes into a room hoping that people will think they're boring and ugly and stupid? Like,
what a glorious way to be, though, not to have any expectations or hopes. Like, just be like, I'm fine.
Oh, like, I don't know what that feels like.
Yeah, no.
I have no center. It only comes from outside. I'm just an amorphous blob. I don't have a soul.
Mary, that's why we're connecting today. How much did you resent or love your name growing up? Because you can't be a boring Emerald Fennell. With a name like that, you have to be an interesting person.
Yeah, I don't know that I'm interesting, actually. I think that it's, well, look, I should first say that I love my parents deeply, and I love my name. And I think it's all the things perhaps that I am, which is unironic and unsubtle and kind of slightly over the top. Firstly, my friends all call me Emmy or Em, so that's always been the case. But like, the thing that I suppose I minded a bit when I was a teenager was it made me very identifiable. So when I'd disgraced myself at some party or other, which was I inevitably did, hard to pin
on that other Emerald. Yeah.
Hard to pin on someone else, you know, right. Your various disgraces. But I mean, look, I love it. It's part of who you are, isn't it? And I love it, and I suppose it was only really that I became a bit older that I realized, you know, and it's not just, you know, it's the way we all are. It's suddenly the realization that the way that we think, the way that we identify ourselves is very different to how the world connects with you. You know, so you're kind of, you have to, you know, try as much as you can to just be comfortable with that. Like I just have no control over the kind of assumptions that people make.
Right.
And so you kind of have to like slightly let it go.
You also have one of my favorite IMDb trivia notations I've seen in some time, and I don't know if it's true or not, but it says here, when she was 7, she told her parents when she grew up, she wanted to write stories about murder and to live in America.
Yeah. I have a video. I have a video of it. My mom sent it to me the night before I started making Promising Young Woman. She sent me a video and we didn't have a camera. So she must have borrowed it off. It was on my, I think, 7th or 8th birthday. And she was planning on doing birthday interviews with me and my sister every year. And then, you know, like life happened. So it was just this one and it's just me. Yeah. And I just said, she said, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I want to be an actress and live in America. And I want to write stories about murder.
I mean, mission accomplished.
My husband was like, oof. The psychotic single-minded pursuit was quite intense. And I don't know why. I don't know why even at that age I was obsessed with murder and sex. Not that I even understood what it was, but I was aware of something troubling. I was always sort of interested in it, trying to kind of glean as much as I could about it because I knew it was sort of scary, but kind of interesting.
I was going to say, it must have brought you tremendous joy to jump into something like Killing Eve, which brings a lot of those loves together.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it was really fun. I mean, that was very, very, very grueling though. I mean, it was incredible, but it was, when I started on Killing Eve, I was just in the writer's room and it hadn't come out yet. And Phoebe was making Fleabag. So the plan had always been that she would do the first season, then she was going off to do Fleabag too. When we started, it hadn't come out yet. So nobody knew that it would be like the hugest thing ever. Right. And then because it was so huge, the studio pushed it forward or brought it for, I never know whether it's pushed back or pulled forward, but basically we had like suddenly 2 months less time.
Got it.
And because it was Britain, it was just, it, I think it was just, it just caught everyone off guard. And So we ended up having for a little time. So I think at one point I was like, I was right. I think I was working in the middle of that series. I was working kind of 20 hours a day just to cover the, because you don't have, you know, it was. And so the thing that I remember most, I'm so proud of it and I love it. And I love that series and I love that show and I love everyone who worked on it. But the thing I remember was literally like crouching over a bin, eating pizza out of the trash because I had no time to like get food and there was no food. I was
glamorous,
like,
yeah, hottest show on TV, and there she is in the corner.
Woman, she's a sexy woman of the world, taking Hollywood by storm, crouched over bin, eating trash pizza. So it was kind of, but it was incredible. It was incredible, and also it was the first time, like, you know, it was I was promoted to the kind of showrunner of that, which was right. Like beyond my wildest dreams, but also like fucking hell, a rude awakening on how to like, you know, get like, you know, learning on the job. But, you know, I remember the first day of shooting, they shut down the Gare de l'Est, the big train station in Paris, you know, because it was that opening scene of the second series, or kind of one of the opening scenes of Eve, you know, remembering she's got a knife in her pocket and she's about to go through security. And I just remember thinking like, oh, my God, I can't believe this is real. Like, I cannot believe this has happened. It was amazing.
I've been lucky enough to get to know Jodie Comer, amazing, over the years, who is just like, can do anything pretty much on the planet. I'm sure you saw Prima Facie, the show. I mean, she's just unbelievable.
Insanely talented.
She was pretty frank with me. Like, she, you know, the divisive ending, and I know you had left Killing Eve by then, but did you have a perspective on how they wrapped it up and Villanelle's fate?
Do you know what? I actually never would, because I think that... I know how hard everyone worked on that show. I know how difficult a job it was for everyone. And so I'm just so impressed by everyone who worked on that show. And you know, and I think, and I have nothing but like love and respect for all of them.
You know the degree of difficulty. I get it. Totally.
Yeah. I really do know the degree of difficulty. And so I think, yeah. So I think they did a great job.
Haven't heard for a while. It was on the Promising Young Woman train that Zatanna came up for you. Did you write the script? Is it still out there with the new regime at DC? Is it still potentially happening?
No, it's not happening. It was, you know what? I met. So this was all before Promising Young Woman, actually. So this was something I was working before Promising Young Woman, and it was when J.J. Abrams had just arrived at Warner Brothers and was going to like reboot the Dark Universe, right. And they were going to take, you know, they were going to kind of make this new kind of like dark sort of villain universe, or sort of hero villain universe. Mm-hmm. And I just thought he was the coolest. His team, Bad Robot, Hannah, his producer, Bad Robot, was so cool and so interesting. And because I love genre of all kinds, you know, so much of Promising Women and Salt Burn are like, you know, prodding at a specific genre that right. I'm definitely interested in, like, oh, okay, I don't know a huge amount about the superhero genre. It's not a genre that I naturally gravitate towards. So I was like, okay, well, I'd love to know how does one make a movie like that for people like me who maybe don't know so much and wouldn't necessarily buy a ticket the first time around. So it's sort of that kind of thing. I'm like, okay, this is interesting. And Zatanna is just a really, really cool character. And yeah, but I think it just like everything, I did write it. It was complicated because I think, you know, the regime, like the things, you know, it's all the, it's the classic studio stuff. Yeah. It's classic studio stuff. JJ's incredible. His team are incredible. And I think it just, I wrote in the end, I think, a script that is reasonably demented.
I would expect nothing less.
I
would.
In a good way, of course. I think it would have been like kind of, but in the end, I think the whole universe got kind of, you know, was changed. And so, but you know, that's fine. I love writing. I love working with people. So it was kind of really fun to do. In the end, whether or not it would have been like remotely makeable,
That's not your job. Your job is just to go batshit crazy and write the story that works for you.
I was only ever slated to write it. So, it was someone else's problem.
Yeah.
To be like, hey, this $500 billion movie with like this 28 minute sex scene in the sky. That's not real.
and was Nemesis ever a real thing? Mark Miller said that you had written a draft or something on his Nemesis.
I did. No. I mean, Nemesis was absolutely brilliant, but I did. I just did a couple of weeks on that one. That was a kind of, it's brilliant. I loved it, but it's kind of I did some work on somebody else's script for them for the studio. Yeah, but I did. I mean, not to say that I didn't love it. I just don't like to take credit for something that I haven't really been instrumental in when somebody else is doing the work.
I mean, you do have, look, only two feature films in, but you have like a very specific path and voice that you have already established. And I would imagine, I mean, you tell me, like, is this the path to continue on for you? Because you're probably getting very interesting, you know, temptations of those kind of movies we just talked about, the comic book things and the big scale things. But like, I would imagine you're in a place where you could do the, you know, $20 to $40 million like drama, because your name is now becoming a little bit of a brand. And I mean that in a positive way, not a crappy, you know, crappy one.
I will
one.
Be coming out with my brand, my personal brand of tampons shortly.
Finally, it's an untapped market in the celebrity. Yeah. But yeah, philosophy-wise, in terms of crafting the career forward, like, are you kind of very single-minded on the kind of films you want to make in the next 5-10 years?
Yes. Yeah. I can't. What I've realized now is I can't. I'm always happy to kind of like do a pass for somebody that I love or a studio for things, and that's always really fun. But in terms of my own things, like scripts that are mine, then I do those to write and direct, and what I will do, go, you know, as long as people let me, I'll do after this is go away, write the thing I want to write. Nobody ever knows what it is. That was the case with Saltburn. Nobody knew what it was, and nobody had any idea until I sent it to my agents and managers when it was finished, so they have the experience as close to watching the movie is, which is like, you can really see if it works or not, I think, if you do it that way. And also I like the pleasure of that. You know, there's a huge amount of pleasure to me about the kind of it being your own thing in secret, in private, that any motivation that you have is purely, it's not financial or, you know, you don't have anyone sitting over you. It's just you and what you want to write about and what you think is interesting and complicated and the thing that you want to get out of your system, you know. And then it gives you so much freedom, because you can say what I said with Saltburn, which was, you know, this is it, this is the thing I want to make next. If anyone else wants to make it with me, I'm so happy. If nobody does, great, I'll go away and write something else,
right?
And it's wonderful, and it's, and I don't think I can work any other way. I can't do this traditional studio mode. I can't pitch an idea and then pitch an outline and then write 10 outlines and then do 6 drafts. I can't do it. It's killer. It's killer. Yeah. And there are some people who love that. I just think you just end up with something that,
well, it's compromised. It's diluted. It's just,
well, it's what it is streamlined in a way that I find it's not knotty. You get everything ironed out quite quickly. And so by the time you even come to shooting, the stuff that's complicated, that is kind of interesting, kind of has to go. And that, I don't know. So I'll just do that. And I think I like having a reasonable budget. I like having a lower end budget, because then you're all working really hard. I like the constraint. I like the boundaries of having not the idea of being able to reshoot endlessly. The idea of having endless money and time makes me just think it gets flaccid and flabby, and you want something to be taught. And also, if it's a bit fucking messy, fine.
Right.
All of the films I love are messy. all of the films from 35 years ago that we think of as being the masterpiece of their time have, you know, 20-minute stretches in the middle that are kind of dull, right, or bits that really don't work, or characters that are like, eh. Every single one of those movies, and I think our relationship with film now is so, you know, we tend to kind of treat things like Death by a Thousand Cuts. We judge it by the thing we wanted to see, not the thing it is. And I think, like, you know, so it's just trying to be determined to make things that are, yeah, they're not completely without any friction, because right, then you just kind of slide out, don't you, of the cinema, and you're like, eh.
Well, it's no surprise. You were proselytizing to me the other day, Beau is Afraid. We, you know. Oh,
I love it so much. That is a movie. That is a movie.
I just want, before you have to run to your 300 other conversations, actors on your short list, because you seem to gravitate towards, I mean, I love Barry. I know you're a big fan of Killing of the Sacred Deer. He's amazing in this one too, Barry Keoghan. Live Wire, who can just kind of do anything. Do you have a short list? I mean, do you write with actors in mind?
I don't write with actors in mind, but I have a list of actors that I'm obsessed with. At the moment, I'd love to work with Josh O'Connor as a director. I think he's so, so special. I mean, Zendaya's kind of a remarkable force of nature, isn't she? Also, I'm obsessed with Skylar. He's in the Righteous Gemstones. Skylar Gisman. Oh, wow.
I don't actually know. I'm rusty on Skylar Gisman.
He's amazing.
Stones.
He's in my favorite other film, Vacation 2015.
Oh, the remake, the one with Ed Helms. Yeah, got it. Okay, I'll look it up. Okay. Oh, I know who you're saying. He's a younger actor, right? Yeah, he's a younger actor.
He's been in loads of stuff. This is terrible, but like I was watching something with him in last night again, and he's in Licorice Pizza, and I was like, ooh, he's really good. He's one of those actors that's just like really, really good. I mean, there are so many people. The list is like 50 people long.
All right, I'm going to end with this. In honor of Happy, Sad, Confused, you kind of just said a few, but an actor who makes you happy, you see them on screen.
Oh, God. Can I say Robert Mitchum?
Sure. Sure. A little Cape Fear makes you thrilled.
It makes me so thrilled. Night of the Hunter, are you kidding? Oh, I told you. I mean, these are the people I love.
Got you pegged. Okay. Movie that makes you sad.
Melancholia. Never cried so much. Existential crisis. Had to lie on the floor for 2 hours. Beautiful. Loved it. Every second of it. Devastating.
And finally, food that makes you confused.
Raisins in salad. Truly. Just fuck off. Life ruining, actually.
Is it the sweetness? You don't want the sweet in your salad? You don't want
I don't want sweet in a salad, but I can deal with an apple, sure. I'm a grown up. But my God, a raisin, a little wizened, wibbly wobbly.
Right.
No.
Okay. No. Not coming out for the raisin lobby. She's got her tampons that she's going to be selling, but not the raisins.
Thank you.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. What I will also, I'll have a raisin brand, which is just an empty box.
trying to destroy the joy for us raisin lovers out there. Emerald, this has been a pleasure. Congratulations on Saltburn. Everybody should check it out. As I told you the other day, I love all your work. I'm obsessed with this one. I'll see it many more times, two down, many more to go. And good luck staying, you know, healthy and sane through the madness. But it's all for a good cause.
All for a good cause. Thank you so much. Lovely to see you.
Good to see you. Enjoy your weird green sitting room.
Thank you. I will. Bye.
And so ends another edition of Happy, Sad, Confused. Remember to review, rate, and subscribe to this show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm a big podcast person. I'm Daisy Ridley, and I definitely wasn't pressured to do this by Josh.